Hello and welcome to The Exit presented by Flippo. This is a 30-minute podcast featuring amazing entrepreneurs who have been there and they have done it. The Exit talks to operators who have bought and sold businesses of all different sizes. You'll learn how they did it, why they did it, and get exposure to the world of exits, a world occupied by a small few, but accessible to many. And before we dive into this episode, be sure to listen to the previous interview with Ryan Condie. He talks about some incredible aspects of acquiring new businesses. But in this episode, I sit down with John Warlow, and we go over a lot of really like prestigious exits. And I smile when I talk about this because he talks through some really cool behind the scenes aspects to buying businesses of all different sizes and going through the exit from the seller's perspective as well as the buyer's perspective. So without further ado, let's dive right into this really special episode here with John Warlow. Hello, everyone. I am joined today with John Warlow, the author of The Art of Selling Your Business and the founder of Value Builder. How's it going today, John?
I'm good, Steve. How are you?
Good. Good. I'm excited to dive into this. I think a lot of people are really going to get some value out of this. And you know, you being the founder of Value Builder, I think it's a really cool, cool interview. So before we dive into Value Builder, let's talk a little bit about your background. What brought you to start the business?
Oh man, it goes way back. I've been involved in four companies that I started and exited. I wrote a book called Built to Sell about 10 years ago that was sort of inspired by some of those journeys. And out of the book came the company, really. People wanted to apply the lessons in Built to Sell to their company. And that's when we built the Value Builder system. And yeah, I've been doing it since 2013, I guess.
Got it. So let's talk a little bit about Value Builder and the Value Builder system. What is it from a high level? And given people were so interested in it, can you just kind of walk us through it?
Yeah, effectively, it's a way to think about your company through the lens of an acquirer. So we have everybody come in and take an intake questionnaire, evaluates your company across the eight dimensions that acquirers look for in businesses that they buy. And we know that out of 100, the typical average company coming in scores a 59. That's the average score. And those businesses are trading at about 3.5 times pre-tax profit. We obviously want to do better than that, and we want to help the entrepreneurs who run those companies do better than that. So over time, we take them through this process of improving their Value Builder score. And if they're able to get their Value Builder score up to 90 out of a possible 100, those businesses on average are trading at 7.1 times pre-tax profit. So more than double when they come in. So that's really the value proposition of the software. It's designed to help you improve the value of your business. And I mean, one of the things that's interesting about it as well is when we look at the number of business owners who have received the written offer to buy their business, the average performer is about 11% of those companies have received a written offer in the last year. Mm-hmm. And the folks who get up to 90, it jumps to about 34%. In other words, you're about three times more likely to get an offer. And so that's cool from an M&A perspective because it allows you to be in the catbird seat, right? Like you're in the driver's seat in the negotiation when you were being courted versus having to court others. And so that's a key dimension. A lot of guys I talk to, they don't want to sell their company, but they want to know that they could. Yeah. And if they did, they would be getting courted and they would be in a position of strength as opposed to vulnerable.
Got it. So you've had quite a lot of years under your belt with this system and having people come to you. So I'm kind of eager to know about some trends. Like what did you notice most over the past few years that people came to you and let's say they didn't have something ready that they could have, you know, that could have helped them increase their score. What could something like that be?
Yeah, I mean, recurring revenue is probably the biggest driver of a premium valuation and also the biggest reason that businesses fail to get a great valuation is that they're one-off revenue, right? And so, you know, the idea is that you really want to create some recurring revenue, meaning some subscription or annuity-based revenue. When I say that, a lot of business owners go, yeah, but like I'm not a software company. That doesn't apply to me. And so what I usually do in that situation is I tell them a story about a company that's changed their model to recurring. I mean, H. Bloom comes to mind. H. Bloom was selling flowers. They, like most flower companies, they deal with lots of seasonality. Most flowers are bought around Mother's Day and Valentine's Day. They also have inventory that dies the moment, you know, the farmer cuts the flower, it starts to die. And it's a kind of crappy business model to sell flowers through a retail shop, if you think about it. And H. Bloom said, okay, how do we reinvent this on a subscription model? And they realized that there are hotels, restaurants, private wealth companies that want to project that very prestigious image by putting a fresh cut bouquet of flowers. And they said, why don't we just sell flowers on subscription? And they built a whole company. The average lifetime value of an H. Bloom subscriber is like $4,500 compared to a typical transaction on flower stores, you know, $50 or whatever. So they built a recurring model in an industry that is generally not lending itself to that. And so when I, you know, I do this thing called Built to Sell Radio, where I've interviewed 300 different entrepreneurs about their exit. And one of the things that I've seen, the ones that get the premium valuations generally have some form of recurring revenue. Even if they're not a software company, they've got some sort of annuity-based revenue.
Interesting. Recurring revenue, I do think is like a huge backbone in terms of leverage when, you know, these businesses are coming to you guys. Let's say they're a flower company or one of these businesses that's building recurring revenue or trying to build revenue. What's some, you know, leverage that they could use in negotiating with a potential acquirer in your experience?
When it comes specific to recurring revenue or just overall, what sort of leverage?
Just overall, in terms of leverage that a business could use to a potential acquirer.
Yeah. So look, I think what really drives up the value of a company and gives an acquirer, gives the seller of a business more leverage is to be able to do the math for the acquirer of what the company is worth in their hands. That's the definition, of course, of a strategic acquisition, where the value of the business is worth more in the hands of the acquirer than it is in the hands of the seller. I'll give you an example. So I did an interview with Stephanie Breedlove for the book. Stephanie Breedlove built a $9 million payroll company. She did payroll for nannies. So effectively, parents who have a nanny to pay would hire her company and they would do the payroll for them. Well, that's a very peculiar niche. Like ADP and Paychex isn't in that space, right? They want big company, you know, payroll accounts. So Breedlove built this little business in this quiet corner of the economy, $9 million of revenue on the backs of about 10,000 customers. And she decided she wanted to sell. It's 25 years in, she thought she'd sell. And she looked out and said, who would this company be more valuable in their hands than it is in mine? And she realized Care.com was growing and like a lot. Mm-hmm. And Care.com, if you don't know, they're like the Angie's List of care providers. Put in your zip code and it'll give you the care providers, the babysitters in your market. And at the time, they had 7 million subscribers. And so Breedlove just made the economic case. She said, look, if you buy my company and just 1% of your subscribers buy my payroll service, that's 70,000 customers, right? Like I'm over here with 10,000 customers in a $9 million business. If 1%, now let's do the spreadsheet at 2% and 5%. And all of a sudden, Care.com is realizing the economic potential of buying Breedlove's business. Long story short, Breedlove sold a $9 million payroll company for $54 million,
Wow. Which
is like an astronomical, like it's a 6X multiple on revenue, which doesn't make any sense. There's no valuator on the planet that would ever put that kind of valuation on a $9 million company. But in Care.com's eyes, that's what it was worth. You know, another example of that would have been Jay Steinfeld's sale of Blinds.com. Have you ever had Jay on the show?
No, not yet. Love to have him on.
So he's a great guy to have on. So Jay built Blinds.com. So around the time Bezos was building and trying to figure out how to sell books online, Steinfeld was trying to figure out how to sell blinds, right? Blinds are more difficult than books, though, because you got to measure them, you got to install them. It's a bit of a kludgy process, right? So he doesn't grow as fast as Amazon, but he grows, and over 30 years builds blinds.com into a $100 million company. So a really big success story. But at the same time, Home Depot is their biggest competitor, and Home Depot is getting their ass handed to them by blinds.com, right? Like, they're number two by a long stretch in the blinds category. And so Home Depot says, enough of that. We want to buy this company because we want to be number one in blinds. But what's a really interesting kind of postscript to the story is the other reason that Home Depot bought blinds.com. And it was because Jay had figured out the secret sauce for selling complicated products online, products that needed to be installed. Because at the time, Home Depot had $90 billion of revenue, but virtually all of it through their retail channel, through their stores. And they were trying to figure out, how do we get people to go to HomeDepot.com and buy stuff online? Because at the time, they were selling nothing online. And so they bought blinds.com for the strategic reason that they wanted to be number one in blinds, but the hidden reason is that they wanted to figure out how to get a bigger proportion of their $90 billion of revenue sold through their online channel. And given the economics of selling through the online channel, there was a huge amount of profit to make in that acquisition. Again, that's another example of sort of a strategic acquisition as opposed to just a financial acquire.
Yeah, I love that. Painting the picture for what it could be in the right hands. And I love that example of the nanny payroll business. I mean, selling for $54 million.
It's crazy.
That's awesome, though, that she was able to paint that picture. And it's a clear picture. Just being able to say, like, yeah, 1% conversion would lead to just that much more revenue. And I love how simple that is. Like, that math just works. Everybody can kind of understand that they have that base already. So you're just selling into that base, and that's fantastic. So with, you know, all that being said, and a couple of really great examples, how do these people know when to sell? I think that this is kind of a common question, and it comes up pretty frequently, but how do people know? I mean, when they're either burned out or what do you see as the reason for a lot of sales? Hey guys, Steve here, and taking a quick pause from the interview. I know that selling a business can feel unattainable and just out of reach for everybody, but it's definitely something that is very reachable for people that are listening to this podcast with Flippa. And I've mentioned that this show is presented by Flippa. They have over 3 million users on their platform who are looking to acquire everything from content sites to e-commerce stores to SaaS platforms or even mobile applications. So if you're curious and want to know more about what your business is worth, head to flippa.com/theexit for free valuations on your business. It takes a couple minutes to literally go through, and you can just go through the whole process without committing to anything at all. So once again, flippa.com/theexit, check it out, get evaluation on your business without any commitments, and just see exactly what your valuation of your business is worth. So let's dive into the interview.
Yeah. So what I see from entrepreneurs is the desire to time the sale of their company, right? So when I say, like, when are you thinking of selling? Oftentimes I'll hear stuff like, well, you know, I want to launch that new product. I want to hit that new revenue milestone. And I want to really kind of maximize the value, really hit the top of our growth trajectory and then sell, which on the surface sounds reasonable. The challenge, though, is for most acquisitions, there's some sort of transition period where you're going to have to go through an earnout or some period where you are employed by your acquirer. And during that time, you want to be on your growth trajectory. You don't want to be at the top of it. And the other piece of it is, I think you run the risk of riding it over the top. And what I mean by that is essentially losing a moment in time when your company is attractive to a third party. I'm reminded of a guy named Rand Fishkin. Have you ever had Rand on the show?
No, but I'm a fan.
He's What a wonderful story. So wrote a great book. Everybody should get it. It's called Lost and Founder. I had Rand on my show and he's in the book. He built a business called Moz, which is a software company that does SEO effectively, and built it up to about $5 million of revenue when in his mind, he'd heard the figure of 4x top line revenue is what SaaS companies were trading at the time. And he was at 5 million in revenue and he expected next year to be at 10. So he was thinking, man, next year, this business could be worth 40 million bucks, 10 million in revenue times four. About the same time, he gets a call from Brian Halligan, who is the co-founder of HubSpot, the all-in-one marketing platform. And Halligan says to Rand, look, we see what you're doing over here at SEO Moz. How about we buy you? We'll pay you 25 million bucks in cash in HubSpot stock. So 5x revenue, pretty good outcome for most people. But again, Rand had this 40 million number in his mind. And so I'm not sure. Decided against it. And Halligan and Rand parted ways. Fishkin said, well, we've got this tail, you know, we've got this great business. Let's raise venture capital. So raised a bunch of venture capital, invested in a bunch of other, you know, service lines, little product lines. And unfortunately, they fell short of his expectations. He started to spiral, cash started to get sucked out of the company. And he actually went through a period of depression, which he's candid about talking about, wherein the venture capitalists removed him from the board. Now, VCs, when they invest in businesses, often use what are called preferred shares, which means they get a preferred return before the common shareholders, the founders, get anything. And so I asked Rand years later, like, what are those shares worth? Like, he had since well been removed from the board and as a CEO spot on his business, but he still had a few shares in the company. And I said, what are they worth today? And he said, probably not much, right? Because the VCs are going to get their preferred return before I get anything. And I said, what would that HubSpot offer have been worth these days? And he said, based on the appreciation in HubSpot stock, it'd be worth close to $200 million.
Wow.
And so I tell you that story in part to answer your question, like, when's the best time to sell a company? It is like, yeah, you could try to get cute and time it perfectly. No one's that good, by the way, but we could all try to time it when the, you know, the stars align. But the very best time is when somebody is making you an offer, because as we talked about at the very beginning, that's when you're in the driver's seat, right? If you're getting courted by Brian Halligan of HubSpot, man, that's a really, really unique place to be. And that gives you leverage. But it also, if you overplay your hand, could end in disaster if you let that opportunity go by. So I think that's one of the biggest mistakes we see people making, is trying to ride it over the top.
Well said. In terms of trends, I want to kind of talk about that. This past year was just chaotic kind of mayhem, I think, for small businesses everywhere. So what did you see in terms of with the pandemic and things like that? What type of businesses were hard hit, were coming to you? What type did you, of business owners did you see?
Yeah, so service businesses got crushed, right? Any business where the primary delivery model was human to human contact. So everything from restaurants to personal services to, you know, anything related to human interaction was absolutely crushed. And roughly half of the economy is a service-based company. So that was where we saw the biggest impact. The other thing though, we had a chance to pull the data out of Value Builder. So as I said earlier, when you start with Value Builder, we get to complete a questionnaire. It takes about 15 minutes to complete, and we ask a bunch of different questions about your company. We got to thinking it would be cool to compare people who completed the Value Builder questionnaire leading up to the pandemic and comparing them to people who completed the questionnaire in the 9 months during the pandemic. So, and when I say this, I'm mindful that the pandemic is in no way over, but we just pulled the data 9 months prior to 9 months during and just compared and contrasted the two. Two very interesting trends came up. One is that sell by date for most owners has moved up by about 20%. So for folks who we analyzed during the pandemic, their appetite to sell sooner has moved forward by 20%. So they're planning to sell much earlier than those prior to the pandemic. The second interesting insight is the proportion of people that plan to do a family transition or a management buyout through an ESOP has dropped dramatically. And in favor of the, and in lieu of, or in lockstep, the proportion of people who are planning to sell to a third party has gone up by about the same amount. So what the story is this, the idea of selling to your kids, passing it down to your kids, selling to your managers has really become less desirable. And what's become much more desirable is sell to a third party. So we think that's because it's been such a stressful year that business owners don't want to pass that albatross down to their kids. They want to sell to a third party and move on. But that's been one of the most interesting findings from our perspective.
Got it. Yeah, I definitely, I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs on a regular basis, and some people did really well. Some people were, succeeding, and some people were very much freaked out and were trying to preserve their cash and just got into cash flow management a lot heavier during the pandemic. So when it comes to that with a potential acquirer and for lack of a better term, desperation, what are some good tactics that people could go through that they don't look desperate? If, for example, my back's up against the corner and my business got a little crushed during the pandemic and somebody, maybe not Brian Halligan, but somebody's courting me, what could I do to not come across as desperate in your experience as a seller of a business?
Yeah, there's something to be said for the magic of the word partner. And so I think by approaching an acquirer with your hat in hand saying, oh, please buy me, you're putting yourself in a really vulnerable position and you're likely to get taken advantage of. Whereas if you were to approach a conversation with a potential acquirer saying, you know what, let's put things on hold for a minute. Let's just really talk about a partnership. I think that is a much better position for you to be in, and it gives you much more negotiating leverage. Rob Walling is another guy I interviewed for the book. So built a great business called Drip, an email marketing software. And he got approached many, many times by the same company. And in each time, he just deferred them. He said, look, we're not ready to sell, but we'd be happy to partner with you. And eventually the value that they were willing to give him continued to go up. And, when it got to the point of entertaining offers in the kind of 9 to 12 times revenue space, it started to get to a point where he was willing to have that conversation. So I think the word partner is critical. In Stephanie Breedlove's case with Care.com, she approached Care in the beginning about a partnership. Mm-hmm. And again, in part, she knew she wanted to be acquired, but it was a much more graceful way to get into that conversation. Another way to do it is to look at that conversation as, hey, we're looking at potentially bringing on an investor. Arik Levy, who sold Luxor One, did that. Arik is Luxor One installs basically lockers into apartment buildings. So for people who buy online, they can have them the package put into their locker. And when Levy went to sell Luxor One, he approached the sale of the business as raising capital for investment. And so he went out and hired a banker and they shopped the deal. He got three investment options and two acquisition offers. And he played one off the other. Ultimately, in that sort of auction process, was able to triple the value of his company just by playing one investor off the other. And ultimately didn't take investment capital, sold the business outright for three times more than he originally received in the original pool of offers. So again, I think just going hat in hand and saying, please buy us, is a recipe for disaster. But I think either approaching it an acquirer saying, would you like to partner with us or would you like to invest, allows you to really maintain some of that negotiating leverage.
Got it. Yeah, that was, It was honestly one of the things that really drew me to you, to bring you on the show and everything, is the fact that the art of selling your business, the book, is effectively teaching people tactics to prevent this predatory kind of behavior of people coming in and overpowering you and making maybe making it seem like you know, not coming across as desperate. Like you're teaching those tactics. So I appreciate that you're doing that, because it's really kind of passing the power to the operator and the entrepreneur, because there are a lot of very predatory type acquisition offers that will come across. I'm sure you've seen some wild ones.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it's a shame, because, you know, we get one shot to sell our company, and just a subtle move, a subtle answer to the wrong question. Like, one of the classic questions acquirers will ask is like, what do you want for your company? And it seems like such a reasonable question, right? Like, we're going to have a negotiation. It's reasonable for me to ask what you want for it. The challenge, though, is answering that question directly is fraught with problems on either end of the equation. If you answer too low, you're putting a ceiling on which you'll never sell your business beyond, right? If you answer too high, you can often look completely ridiculous and turn off an acquirer and say that guy's, you know, not worth negotiating with because they have such an outlandish number in their mind. So in either scenario, you're really shooting yourself in the foot. I'm reminded a guy I interviewed for the book, this guy named Chris Jones. Chris built a wonderful company called Pepper Jam. They do like affiliate marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a call from Michael Rubin. You probably know Michael Rubin. You certainly know that name. Mm-hmm. So GSI to PayPal. Anyways, he built Pepper Jam, good little business. And Chris got a call from Michael Rubin and say, hey, why don't you come down and see me? I'm thinking it'd be kind of fun to share, you know, break bread with a fellow technology guy. And so Chris Jones walks into Rubin's office thinking this is going to be a great conversation. And instead of being on his own, Michael Rubin, this tech luminary, is in fact flanked by his CFO and his head legal counsel. And Rubin, without really exchanging kind of pleasantries, says to Jones, all right, what do you want for Pepper Jam? And Jones is totally unprepared for the question, right? Because he's like, I thought we were just here to chat. And Rubin looks him in straight at him again and said, no, like, what do you want for your business? And Jones kind of hesitated and blurted out his number. And Rubin, without really reacting to the number, just turned to his chief financial officer and said, okay, I think we can get a deal done. And I asked Jones later, I said, like, if you'd had that over to do again, like, is there anything you'd do differently? He said, yeah, I probably shouldn't have blurted out my number, because, you know, the deal closed at about that number. And I'll wonder, you know, did I leave money on the table? Was there more to be had? Now, Chris has gone on to have a tremendous career and lots of success. But if he had that question to do over again, he might do it differently. And I think rehearsing questions like that, why do you want to sell your company? Another one that is a disaster waiting to happen. There's a lot of wrong ways to answer that question. What do you want for your company? Again, very, very problematic answering that question. But they're all savvy negotiators. The people that business owners are dealing with, like, this is their job. They buy companies, right? And almost always there's this thing called the 5-to-20 rule, which states the natural acquirer for your business is between 5 and 20 times your size. So by definition, you're dealing with a David and Goliath battle, right? And you're David. And so you got to have some tools to punch back, because punch well above your weight, because without it, you're playing with one hand tied behind your back. They're so sophisticated. They've done it so many times that they'll use a subtle question like, what do you want for your company, to basically get your business for way less than it's worth.
Yeah. The shock factor of just throwing it out there. That's incredible that he thought it was a conversation, just, you know, hanging out, talking about technology and things like that. And then it just throws him right at.
Yeah.
Well, that's a fantastic segue into the finale question here that I'm sure a lot of listeners are eager to hear about, because knowing what you know now, you know, you've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of entrepreneurs. What would you tell John 10 years ago?
You know, this is probably not going to be the answer you were hoping for or wanted. It would actually be more of a personal bit of wisdom, I think. We had, when I sold my last company, I was 38, and my wife and I took our young kids, at the time, aged 3 and 5, I think, or something like that, to Europe. We thought, you know, what a great opportunity to kind of pull up stakes and change our life completely. And we moved to Europe, and we were there for 3 years and put our kids in school and did the whole thing. And I got the itch to do something else about 9 months after getting there. Like, I was sort of like, kind of bored, a little bit intellectually not challenged. And so started to, you know, think about what ultimately became the Value Builder System. If I had it to do over again now, I think I probably would have taken more time to just be there and really get the sale of my last company out of my system. And I don't know that I did that. I think it would have been better to take that sabbatical and really, really decompress. I think, you know, one of the things that entrepreneurship affords you is the opportunity to look at life in sort of 10-year chunks, meaning you don't have to go from one rung of the career ladder to the next to the next. If you're a partner at a law firm, you can't step off the ladder, right? If you work at Ford, you can't step off the ladder. But as an entrepreneur, you can. Like, you could sell your company, take a couple of years, do something else, learn to surf, learn to, you know, cook or whatever, and then go start another company. And I think if I had it to do over again, I might have just enjoyed that time a little bit more. I mean, don't get me wrong, we enjoyed it immensely, but I think I could have potentially decompressed a little more had I just said hard stop on any business activity for 3 years. I think that would have been maybe what the advice I would give myself today had I had the opportunity to do it over again.
Well said. Well said. Well, we've covered a ton, like how all of these pretty much infamous and famous exits have happened. Like, you gave us some pretty incredible examples of these big, big, big exits and how they happened and some of these great tactics that you're teaching in your book. So the last bit here is, where can people go and learn how to get your book, listen to your show? How do you want people to find out more?
Yeah, I think just go to builttosell.com. And if you opt in with an email address, we'll send you a different episode of Built to Sell Radio every week. Every week, I interview an entrepreneur who's sold their company and ask them, what would you do differently? What were the tips and tricks that you learned the hard way? And so it's a library of 300 interviews, and we do a new one every week, and it's free. So that's probably the best place to go.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom on the show today, John. I appreciate it greatly. And I know a lot of the listeners will appreciate this as well.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity, Steve.